Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. LVMH, the Paris-based luxury goods conglomerate, in May announced that Rihanna's clothing brand, Fenty, would join the family. The news arrived a few months after Gucci had formally apologized for a turtleneck sweater that evoked images of blackface. And that was far from the only time a house of fashion has crossed the line into designs or aesthetics considered culturally insensitive. Many believe that those failings are the result of a lack of diversity in the business, from the runway to the boardroom. We're talking about why diversity matters in fashion. Jessica Andrews is Deputy Fashion Director for Refinery 29. That's a digital media and entertainment company focused on women. She joins us now. Welcome to the show, Jessica.
Thank you for having me.
We can see from the runway shows that the models represent more diversity every year. What about behind the scenes? What do we know?
Well, behind the scenes is not the same story. And I think that that's where some diversity reports fall short. Last season, New York got a lot of praise for having the fifth season in a row where every show had at least one model of color. But behind the scenes, change is not happening as fast. The majority of fashion companies aren't hiring minorities in high-stake roles, nor are they giving them the freedom or the space to actually use their voices and sound off on issues.
You know, I think about when I'm thinking about behind the scenes, I'm thinking the boardroom to begin with. And most big fashion houses are still run by white males, right?
Absolutely. Before Rihanna, there were only about three black designers that were ever in charge of luxury fashion houses, and they were all men. Olivia Mustang at Balmain, Shane Oliver at Helmut Lang, and Virgil Abloh, who's now at Louis Vuitton Men. So she's now the first black woman in history to helm a luxury brand and the first woman, period, at LVMH.
Is this just, for lack of a better word, and it is Rihanna, and she's no one's token, but be that as it may, whenever you're the first, people suspect that.
Absolutely, because there's a lot of tokenism in the fashion industry. There's a lot of talk about diversity when there's only one person in the role, who oftentimes is the face, but behind the scenes, you'll often find a staff just full of white people. Mm-hmm. But what we want is for there to be inclusion at every level, at leadership levels, all the way down to the bottom. There needs to be inclusion throughout these companies for us to see change. And a lot of times when you have brands who do something that's culturally or racially insensitive, it's because they don't have inclusivity behind the scenes.
And Rihanna, from what we know of her, she's a very strong female. She's a force of nature. This is something that's important to her?
Absolutely. I mean, she's not only breaking boundaries with her role as a leader, but she also hired Zuma Weaver as the label's style director, who's a black stylist who she's worked with in the past. She's also casting models of different races and ethnicities and ages. So she's making sure her commitment to inclusivity is on all different levels. And that's what we want to see from the fashion industry as a whole.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. The Paris-based luxury goods conglomerate LVMH in May announced that Rihanna's clothing brand Fenty would join the family. That makes her the first African-American woman to ever reach that kind of height in fashion. It comes after years and years of gaffes by the fashion industry when it comes to diversity issues. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. My guest right now, Jessica Andrews, she's a deputy fashion editor at Refinery 29. You wrote about the diversity of Fall Fashion Week in 2016, Jessica. You looked at 312 shows and nearly 9,000 model castings from New York, London, Paris, and Milan. So we're talking about these are the big runways. These are the ones everybody talks about. What did you find?
Well, in the last fashion diversity report that we looked at, we saw that every show had at least one model of color, which we would praise as progress, except for the fact that one model of color in a sea of white models isn't significant or really impactful in the long run. Mm-hmm. What we're seeing right now is a lot of tokenism from brands in the industry where they'll have one model who's a star, whether it's a curvy model like Ashley Graham or it's a black model like Jordan Dunn, but they're not being inclusive on different levels on the runway or behind the scenes. So the next change we want to see is for that inclusivity to be well-rounded.
And there's another aspect to all of this, and that's natural black, being natural instead of trying to fit some kind of cookie cutter vision. Now, of course, the big runways are famous for how they, you know, style the models sometimes very similarly to make the clothes stand out, right? But what about that issue?
Well, I think that uniformity is an excuse a lot of designers use, and they'll say that they just want one look on the runway. I think that that's pretty outdated and antiquated. Right now, we're saying that consumers want to have runways that reflect them, and that means that the world is inclusive. The runway should be inclusive. I believe you can have uniformity with models of different races and different sizes. It really comes down to the design. Mm-hmm. To say that, you know, uniformity is the reason that you're only hiring white thin models, that just seems to me like an excuse to continue to be racist or sizist.
Yeah, I remember Project Runway famously would have different challenges that would deal with size, but one season, every model was not a normal model size. They were more normal sized. And I loved seeing the designers start crying. They said, I can't do this. This is just, but how
it's
do?
It's interesting to see, because I think that if you're the best at what you do, you should be able to design for different sizes and shapes. You can't call yourself an expert when you can only do one body type or only work with models of one race, you know? As a fashion director, I know brands that are, you know, obviously really major and luxury, like Rihanna's brand. But I also look for emerging brands and indie brands. Mm-hmm. It's my job to know all of it. And I think that it's not unfair to ask the same of designers.
Do you see something like Fenty? As you mentioned, it's a luxury brand. I can't, you know, normal people can't afford what she's selling. But how does it affect down the food chain then?
Well, I think that people look to Rihanna and LVMH as fashion authorities, and they really kind of set the tone for what the rest of the fashion industry follows behind. We've seen Rihanna be really revolutionary when it comes to beauty, when she launched her Fenty Beauty brand and had 40 shade foundation range. The rest of the industry scrambled to catch up. Mm-hmm. We also saw her make waves in the lingerie space with Savage X Fenty. It's one of the biggest lingerie brands that's size inclusive. And it really sent waves throughout that market as well. So people really look to Rihanna as a leader. They look to luxury brands as leaders. And I think that they're going to follow suit once they see her success and also the praise that she gets from within the industry for being inclusive.
Where do you see emerging brands making an impact now?
Well, I think there are a lot of emerging brands that I'm excited about that are making an impact, even if they don't have the same platform that Rihanna does, mm-hmm. Whether it's Christopher John Rogers, whether it's Pierre Moss, who just won the CFDA Fashion Fund Award last year. But these brands are really making noise, and they're getting a cult following because they're standing true to their values, and they're really basically changing the industry from within, even if on a smaller scale. So I think that, you know, it's not going to take just the major brands like Fenty. It's also going to take the inclusive emerging brands who are making a statement and, you know, making sure to hire models of different races and sizes to really see a difference throughout the industry.
Do you feel like when you walk into a Nordstrom's or a Macy's or a wherever that you're seeing the impact on the mannequins yet?
Not entirely. Actually, we just are doing a story now about Nike launching plus-size mannequins, and that's really sent a wave throughout the industry because, unfortunately, that's not the norm. It should be, but it isn't. And there are people that respond to that that are really excited to support Nike, and there are people that are upset as well. So I think that a lot of times with commerce, people are a little bit hesitant to step into that change because they don't want to isolate consumers or push them away. But I think it's going to be the brands like Nike that take a stand that are actually going to have lasting success in the market.
Is there when it comes to designers of color, designers, you know, of any kind of ethnicity at this point, what's the trajectory for them? Are their designs supposed to look necessarily different than what we're used to seeing out there?
I think that every designer should be aiming to be different and unique. Mm-hmm. I think that every designer should be offering something new and exciting to the conversation, no matter what their background is. And it's important, especially in American fashion, to carve a lane and really stand out from the crowd. And we're seeing that with Fenty, for example. Rihanna obviously is a style icon, but her first line that she released is like nothing we've seen before in luxury. And I feel like if American fashion is going to evolve, everyone needs to be imaginative and everybody needs to kind of create their own lane. And Rihanna is a great example of that.
The Council of Fashion Designers of America last year surveyed those working in the design industry, 41% of whom rated their organization a 3 out of 5 for diversity in their organization. And we have the same kind of surveys that go through our outfit. How does the industry respond to those kinds of revelations? Is that what gets them to make movement, or is it more like public shaming, like when Gucci had that total misfire with the turtleneck sweater, or you know, or Marc Jacobs with his misappropriation of ethnic look, like the dreadlocks. Yeah,
right. I think it's going to take every single method in order to bring about change. I've been working in the fashion industry for over 15 years, and the progress has been really slow. And I think when you have an organization like the CFDA speak out and do surveys, people respond to it because they're a leader in fashion, and they're obviously well-respected. But I think there's something really phenomenal about people using social media as a platform to have a voice and to amplify their voices. Because once consumers speak out, brands pay attention because it hits them in the bottom line. And we've seen that obviously with Gucci, who you mentioned. After the blackface episode, they hired a diversity council. They started working with Dapper Dan, and they took really intentional steps about being more inclusive. And I think that I wonder if that would have happened had we not used social media as a platform. So I think it's going to take different methods and different approaches, but we're all working toward the same goal. Hmm.
Jessica Andrews, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Jessica Andrews is Deputy Fashion Director at Refinery 29. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. And we're going to continue our conversation about diversity in fashion, what it means and what it looks like with the chair of the fashion design at the Columbus College of Art and Design, and also with a local designer of the Columbus-based Amamre. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
In WOSU Public Media's newest podcast series, Rivet, young people share their unique pathways to professional success. Listen to This American Graduate Project. Find Rivet now in WOSU's mobile app or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. Rihanna has become the first Black woman to run a luxury fashion house in Paris. LVMH, the world's largest luxury goods conglomerate, in early May revealed that her brand, Fenty, would join the Paris-based fashion house. But that's the exception. Diversity in the fashion world remains a challenge. Suzanne Cotton is the chair of fashion design and an associate professor at the Columbus College of Art and Design, and she joins us. Welcome, Suzanne.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Fine, thanks. Esther Sands is the CEO and designer of Columbus-based Amamre. Esther Sands joins us as well. Welcome.
Hi, Anne. Thanks.
Esther, you describe your aesthetic as Afrofusion.
Yes.
You combine fabrics and prints from your native Ghanaian culture and with the patterns and silhouettes of Asia.
Yes.
So I guess what came first, the chicken or the egg? Did you get into fashion because you weren't seeing what you wanted to wear? Or are you just at heart and in your soul a designer and just that's where you were going to go anyway?
I've always been an artist, and it's more of I couldn't find things that fit my body right as well. So I started really taking in my clothes, just making clothes for myself, and friends and family were like, you should start making it more for other people. And I've always been into different cultures, different traditions, because they help you understand the people that you meet, the people that you talk to every day. So it's my way of telling people different stories, or them telling their own stories through clothes.
Do you mass produce?
No, right. I haven't yet. I only do small productions.
Is that a goal?
I'm not sure if I want it to be a more a huge brand or just a small luxury brand at the moment.
Which is kind of part of the issue, Suzanne, is it not? That a lot of times you see them in small shops, in boutiques, or you see something that represents what, in my eyes, diversity at art festivals. Mm-hmm. There's lots of cool stuff. And that the last time I talked to you was at the Columbus Arts Festival a few years ago. There are designers are out there.
Oh, for sure. I mean, you know, at CCAD, our program's quite diverse. And I think, you know, in the industry has come a long way in the mass market as far as people working, you know, for mass market brands. I think it's just not risen to the top of where in the Paris big collections, you know, you're still very white male oriented. I think there are a lot of people working behind the scenes, and I graduate a very diverse group every year. So there's certainly people working out there, but I just think it's still the leaders and the big decision makers are the ones now that need to be changed.
I think of that scene in The Devil Wears Prada, where, you know, the head of Vogue is saying, you don't realize that that color blue of the sweater you wore was chosen especially for you. But it goes back several years to where somebody decided that that blue was going to be the blue. Do you feel dictated to even still, Esther Sands, when it comes to the colors and the what the style's going to be and how to fit into that?
Very much so, actually. And mine is more some people call it the industry standards.
Okay.
And I don't think my aesthetic fits into that industry standard. So then how do I fit into the industry? And it's more what colors are in and what colors are not in. Should I be following the trend, or do I want something that is long lasting and not just a trend that will pass away?
Right. And do you actually respond to that in ways you try to sell?
Sometimes I do, especially now that one of the colors this year is mint. Sometimes I do because I love the color, but most times I just follow what I think looks good and how I want to represent my brand and to represent my clients.
Suzanne Cotton, how do you teach your students or how does one teach the idea of taking that kind of a risk and departing from the industry standards? Because that's kind of how you learn.
Well, I definitely think we've definitely encouraged students to really have their own design aesthetic. My experience when I was in school was they told us we all were going to be Seventh Avenue designers, and they wanted to form us into that. And I really looked at that and didn't agree with that. And at the time, you know, the models were all tiny, and it wasn't me. And so when I became an instructor and then department chair, I really made it a mission to encourage people to be creative unto their own self. And I think that the industry, I think the customers out there want something new and different. And it's really important to help the students realize their own vision and not feel like they have to be a cookie cutter. Even if eventually they're going to go work for somebody else's aesthetic, I think it's important that they have their own vision. And I think that's what's going to end up changing the industry.
And as far as people like Esther Sands going off on their own and breaking out, what is that a personality thing? Or is that somebody that just has such a strong vision they have to go that route?
I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, I have plenty of students who, you know, start out, they go in, they get an industry job, and they do that for a few years and then they decide maybe that, you know, they want to do their own collection. And I think that today with technology and fabric printing, and it's a lot more doable than it was 20 years ago. So I think you're going to start to see many more people be able to go out on their own and do, you know, a collection, make a collection and have it be, you know, saleable. Because of some technology that's come along.
It's so on the other hand, it seems like on the other side of the equation is, of course, the consumer. And we've also been trained, have we not, Esther Sands, to buy certain things at certain times. You know, what about the no white before Memorial Day, these ridiculous rules? But be that as it may, that's something you're contending with. You kind of have to teach your customers, don't you, what you're doing?
Yes. And really, most of my client base are people that actually don't want to follow the norm, don't want to be that cookie cutter put in that box. They want to show their individuality. They want to tell their own story. And that's what I go for. Those are the people that I market to, the people that actually want to stand out and are not following trends.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about diversity in the fashion industry. If you have a question or comment, what do you think? Is it diverse enough for you? Are you seeing the kind of designs out there that match your personality, match what you want to look like, match what you want to wear? Because there's a lot of other issues, isn't there? It's not just what the aesthetics are, but it's also the materials that are used and so forth. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. My guests are Suzanne Cotton. She's chair of fashion design and an associate professor at the Columbus College of Art and Design. And also Esther Sands, CEO and designer of Amamre. That's her own aesthetic is Afrofusion. And you can find that here in Columbus. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Sometimes, I mean, I've been in Columbus for 30 years now, so I kind of take it for granted, but a lot of cities don't have the diversity even that Columbus has. Right, Suzanne Cotton? I mean, it's...
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, I think we're lucky here to have such a diverse community, and especially of artists.
Right.
You know, I think so many people, especially in fashion, you know, they came maybe to work for the bigger brands and then have gone off on their own, have found that Columbus is a really great place to live. So I think it's a big plus for us in the community.
And Esther Sands, were you just born here or did you make your way here?
No, actually, I moved here in 2006. So my parents were already here and myself and my siblings joined them.
Okay. And what is your sense about the local scene for fashion?
It's more, I always think it's my brand for Columbus per se, because of what is usually put out there is more the trends that are going on right now.
Mm-hmm.
So we become the token diversity.
Hmm. When you participate in different kinds of shows and
exactly.
That kind of a thing?
Exactly. We are kind of, we are the token diversity. So to kind of market, we are a diverse Columbus. But there are a lot of diverse designers in Columbus, but you don't really hear about them. Because the platforms that are put out there, most of them, or the biggest ones, don't really push the diverse designers more. And they try and pretty much let you know to fit into that industry standard.
Yeah. And how do you describe it? Like that when so I guess diversity in and of, how do you even begin to describe diversity? Mm-hmm. It's in the eye of the beholder, right? You say you feel like a token. How is the more diverse end of the spectrum of fashion in Columbus? How does it help each other? How do they help each other?
They are more open to helping each other learn. For someone like me who's self-taught,
mm-hmm.
So I usually learn from online or ask different designers. Most of those designers are more open to sharing to what they've learned, if they went to school, what they learned in school, or what they've picked up from not being in school, kind of.
And Suzanne Cotton, are you comfortable that you're attracting all the diversity that you'd hope for to a school like the Columbus College of Art and Design or wherever you wherever you attended, I mean, because there's people like Esther Sands, you know, she's self-taught.
Yeah, I think, I mean, like I said, I mean, our program is really quite diverse. We're a small program, but, you know, we have very equal amount. You know, we have a lot of international students that mm-hmm. come in. So we have quite a few people coming from Asia. We have quite a few Black people, white people. And, you know, it's funny because it's always been more female driven. But lately, kind of in the opposite spectrum, we've had more straight men coming in, which has been really great. So.
What do you make of, though, that thing about the fashion industry that the consumers are mostly women, although increasingly men, granted. And, you know, there's that the models are mostly women until pretty recently, and now increasingly diverse, mm-hmm. I think, is the runways is to me kind of like the front end of it.
Yeah.
But that the industry itself has been for so long dominated by white males. What do we know about why that is?
Well, I think,
I guess they dominated everything. And
yeah, I mean, I think that's, I mean, when I was in school, that was just the given. I mean, you know, you were kind of, everyone that came in besides Donna Karan and a few other women that came in were white males. And, you know, so I definitely think there was no talk of diversity. There was no talk of any sort of diversity in size and color, anything, you know. So, you know, but the world has changed so much. But I think at the end of the day, people that are making decisions to hire, you know, at the upper level are don't want to take the risk. You know, it's a tough time in the industry. You know, so I think the people that do take the risk are going to be the winners at the end. You know, slowly you see, and I think more really in mass market, you see, you know, the plus size mannequins in the store,
right.
So much more.
Well, in the catalogs, a lot more plus size.
Yeah, I mean, that's where the business is.
And in fact, in some of the most staid of the catalogs, mm-hmm. Talbots, you know,
yes.
You know, all that kind of a thing.
You know, and I think by, you know, producing lines, you know, many companies now, you know, produce lines from, you know, your extra, extra small 3 or 3X, and it's the same style. You know, my experience growing up was, you know, it was a separate category. And I think, so that's changing a lot. I think I see my students going out, they go out into the design world, you know, and they are much more inclusive. The work that they're presenting on the runway and their senior collections is very personal. You know, if it's, we had gender neutral this year, you know, inclusive in disability. Last year we had a student who, you know, did a children's line for, you know, children with disabilities.
Right.
And I think, you know, that they have the confidence to want to celebrate, you know, what they are and present that to the world. I think this is the generation that's going to go out and really change it. And I think it takes a while to get to that upper level of design. I mean, you know, those are people probably more in my generation still. But we have all these new people coming in who, you know, and we've really at CCAD done a lot to try to, you know, talk about culture appropriation, diversity, you know, encourage people to really look at that.
I was talking to Jessica Andrews, the deputy fashion editor at Refinery 29, she talked about the influence of digital media mm-hmm. and social media. And we talked about how that brought about some quick reactions from, say, the Marc Jacobs people, Gucci, which has offered a formal apology for their misguided notion about what the turtleneck should look like, and in depicting what it amounts to a blackface. With that, what do you think, Esther Sands, as far as being able to get that out? Because it's not just a human generational thing. It's also a technological generational thing, as you mentioned, as far as printmaking goes and that sort of thing.
When it comes to something like that, like she was saying, the more, to me, the cultural appropriation and cultural appreciation has a very fine line.
Huh.
With how I design, I design incorporating a lot of different cultures. If someone else sees it, they would think it's cultural appropriation. But the people that actually are trying to represent their culture see it as an appreciation of culture. So where does that line begin and where does it end? Because I'm trying to put that culture out there. Even though I'm adding my own culture to it, I'm not trying to take away from that culture. I think understanding that culture helps you understand the people. So am I appropriating that culture or am I appreciating that culture? Mm-hmm. So it's pretty much individual perceptions.
Yeah, that's an interesting fine line.
Well, and I think that is it can be difficult. You know, there's no right and wrong answer. You know, I think, you know, I it's funny because a few years ago I bought a dashiki top and I love it, you know, and but then, you know, I was like, is that right? Should I wear that? Is that respectful? And I asked a few of my students about it. I said, well, you know, what do you think about that? Because I think this is beautiful and I want to celebrate it, but I also don't want to offend anyone. Mm-hmm. And so I do think it's difficult sometimes to know the right answer. And especially as an educator, my students look to me to say, oh, is this appropriate or is that... And sometimes I'm like, I don't know. Maybe we should ask. You know, we should. And,
well,
and that's always my
diversity, though, in your classrooms is then people can talk among themselves. But when you're just all a bunch of white people in a, in a white room
and
kind of a thing, who are you going to ask?
That's what the industry really needs to, you know, have a representative. So you could say, and I think they would get in less trouble because if your group then says, oh, yeah, you know, I think that's great. You know, or no, I wouldn't do that. You know, I think that's important.
Yeah, and for me, for someone wearing a dashiki, to me, it's not appropriating my culture.
Yeah.
Because it's you trying, loving my culture enough to try and represent it. If you're not representing it as like a Halloween costume or something like that, to me, it's an appreciation of my culture. You're not appropriating it just because you're not my skin color. Doesn't mean that you can't wear what I wear. You can wear the same prints I wear.
So when Marc Jacobs had all of his models, most of whom that year, the spring collection for 2017, so it occurred probably in 2016, I would imagine, were all mostly white. I think all but one were white, but they were wearing dreadlocks. That's appropriating. That's different?
It depends, I guess you can say. Because if... Maybe if his models were more all different colors, not just mostly predominantly white.
Right.
If maybe the models were all different ethnicities, all different races, then that wouldn't come off as much as appropriation as this has. Because Marc Jacobs is a big brand and people pay attention to big brands. So when you're putting that out there, you have to think, what would the backlash be?
Or you should have somebody nowadays thinking about it.
Exactly.
You'd think.
But it sounds like nobody could speak up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And I do. I agree with you as far as, you know, if you had a very, you know, mixed people, you know, of mixed races and it was, you know, done with a little more thought, I think it would probably not have stood out as much.
Yeah.
You know, I think, you know, I know with our fashion show, I always tell my students, I'm like, we need the models to represent how diverse we are as a group. And I think, to me, it just seems like I don't understand why you wouldn't want to show your line to the biggest group of people you could and be inclusive, you know, in color, in size, in, you know, because that's going to give you more customers. So I would think it would be.
It is still, at the end of the day, it is a business.
I mean, you know.
Because at the end of the day, you're selling to the people seeing your work.
Yeah.
So you want to be as wide as possible to.
Within your aesthetic.
Yes. To reach as many customers, clients, family as possible. So you're trying, because when people see things, they are like, they think about, how does it relate to me? So we're always more self. How does it relate to me? So how is it going to relate to a black girl? How is it going to relate to a white girl? How is it going to relate to an Asian girl? So it's all how it relates to the specific one client.
We're going to continue our conversation about diversity in the fashion industry. That's Esther Sands. She's CEO and designer of Amamre. Also with us, Suzanne Cotton. She's a chair of fashion design and an associate professor at the Columbus College of Art and Design. If you have a question or comment, want to weigh in, we would welcome it. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Mike Thompson.
And I'm Steve Brown, and we are the hosts of Snollygoster, WOSU's podcast all about politics in Ohio.
Each week, we chat about what the shrewd politicians at the State House are up to and how national politics affects us here at home.
Find out why listeners have called us a weekly must-listen. For a lighthearted yet in-depth look at Ohio politics, subscribe to Snollygoster wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The world's largest luxury goods group, LVMH, in May announced that Rihanna's clothing brand Fenty would join the French conglomerate's house, making her the first woman of color to do so. But most of the rest of the business remains largely white. We're talking about the challenge of diversity in fashion. Still with us, Chair of Fashion Design, Associate Professor at Columbus College of Art and Design, Suzanne Cotton. Also with us, Esther Sands. She's the CEO and designer of Amamre. She describes her fashion as Afrofusion. She combines fabrics and prints from her Ghanaian culture with the patterns and silhouettes of Asia. And if you want to see an example, I think she's wearing one right now. So if you go online and check it out, you go to WOSU.org/allsides and you can see for yourself. So when we were off air, we were having an interesting conversation about what amounted to in the end, the scope of fashion, that it's international. And Suzanne Cotton, you were making the point that what the aesthetic or what the what might be so what might be ethnic appropriation in the United States, given our history, is very different, is looked at very differently, say, in on the runways of Paris.
Oh, for sure. I mean, you know, in France, you're French or you're not French. I mean, and it's and you have to be completely, you know, it's not diverse. And I think so those companies are, you know, they there's a lot to preserving the Frenchness of the world in France, the language, the, you know, it's a whole different mindset than in the United States that, you know, we want to be more diverse and more open. And so I
because we have a lot of work to do.
Yeah.
I mean,
and
we have
I
a bad history.
And, yeah. Yeah. And so I think it's, you know, right out of the gate. I mean, I spent a year in Paris when I was in school, and it was stunning to me the difference of attitude just because, you know, you were French or you were not French, and they didn't really, you know, that wasn't a concern. There were certain things you could do if you were French and, you know, you would be accepted, and if not, then that was, you just weren't, you know. So I do think that that makes a difference.
But with you know, LVMH taking on the Fenty line, you know, making Rihanna the first African-American, first woman of color at that level, they're saying, yeah, okay, now we're starting to change.
Well, I think, you know, again, the
it's
industry
a bottom line
is,
issue.
Yeah, it's, I mean, they're looking at the dollar signs, and I think a lot of companies are, you know, it's a struggle. So, you know, I think they're looking for a new way to do things. So I think that's a really exciting thing.
And I think it's more our generation right now is more inclusive. Mm-hmm. We want to learn about all different cultures.
Actively inclusive, not
yes.
just in thought.
Yes.
Right.
We actually go out of our ways to learn about what makes a person that person. So in not marketing to that generation, you're losing a lot of money. So now I think the brands, the big brands are trying to market to all of the generations coming up to try and get them to buy in more. So now they're trying to be more inclusive, I guess you can say.
I mean, you make a living, right?
Yes. Yes,
I do. This isn't just a hobby.
No, no. This is something that I'm very passionate about. And it's a little personal because it's a way of me expressing myself. And I like people that wear my clothes to be able to express themselves through my clothes. So you wearing it makes you tell your story in the way you want to tell it.
What advice do you give to other women of color or diverse ethnic backgrounds to become a part of the fashion industry then? Do you think it really mostly boils down to the Rihannas of the world are far and few between unique? I think we can safely say right now. And that it's going to work better if you take it on yourself with your own company?
I guess it should be preference, really, to what you want to do.
Yeah, because everyone's not cut out to be an entrepreneur, for one
thing. Yeah, it's really hard work. And trying to figure out who to go to or who to talk to or the doors that can open for you from a minority woman, it's really hard to know who can I talk to get the opportunity to advance my brand. Will they open the door for me or would they shut the door in my face? So it's always a debate of how and who and where to go to.
It's such a who you know kind of a business, mm-hmm. is it not?
Well, Susan? You know, and I think too, you know, when you're looking at the Gucci's and the Marc Jacobs, and that really is a one in a million. You know, those mm-hmm. those jobs, you know, I have parents that come through with their children and, oh, this is just a pipe dream. You know, they're never going to be. But I'm like, those are just the very few. I mean, you think about there's, you know, what, 50 maybe major designers out there. So, yes, that is kind of the chance to become at that level. It is, you know, a very slim chance. But every single garment that every single person has on has to be designed, and that's a job. So I think for a lot of these jobs, it is very open, and I graduate people, and they were working all across the country, mm-hmm. but it's a career. You know, you're not becoming have any hopes of ever becoming that name brand. And for most people, you know, you have a wonderful career doing that, and there's nothing wrong with that. And by and far, so I think there's kind of two situations going on. You know, it's not, you know, being an actor, you want to be the famous actor.
Right.
But there's, you know, many people acting as careers all across the country in a small way, too. So I think, you know, you got to kind of keep it a little bit in perspective, because I think I have plenty of people who are going out and finding jobs and mm-hmm. careers and being successful.
Yeah, and there are many aspects of the fashion industry. So it's not just you becoming a designer yourself. Mm-hmm. So the idea that is put out there is more of if you're not your own designer or if you don't have your brand, you don't have a place in the fashion industry. But that's not true, because there are a lot of different opportunities in the fashion industry. You can go and be a seamstress for one of the brands. You can be a merchandiser for one of the brands. So it's not just you becoming an entrepreneur for yourself. You can go out and try and work for different companies as well.
There are things like in journalism, the National Association of Black Journalists and that kind of a thing. Are there similar organizations for people that represent any kind of minority group in the fashion industry?
I mean, I don't really feel like there are many things like that in the industry in general.
Yeah, okay.
You know,
it's not a groupie kind of.
It isn't a groupie kind. No, it's funny because I think as I moved to Edgewood, because I was a sweater designer for years, you know, so I was in that side for a long time, and it was very like, you know, you never really saw anybody else anywhere else, and I think the companies tend to be their own kind of group. But so in education, when I moved into that, I was like, oh, this is like there are a lot of groups to get involved in, and so it is a little bit more social, I guess.
Yeah. And sharing.
Yeah.
Or just hanging out and being around people that look like you or think like you in a pretty big industry.
Yeah. Yeah. In Columbus, there is a good group. Not like a clique. There are some that are cliques, but there are groups that will actually meet, help each other. You can call them, you can send them a message, get together once in a while and just bounce off ideas or just eat or just have fun. And that is a good way to actually feel like, and it's almost like an affirmation of what you're doing.
When you're designing something, Esther Sands, do you see someone like me? White, old, wearing it?
Yes, I see everybody wearing my designs. It's more of how do you feel? My client feels. So you coming to me is, that means you want to wear something different, something bold, something that makes you...
Stand out from the crowd.
Exactly. So that is my aesthetic. So if you come to me and it doesn't matter what race, what age, and you want to feel that way, I will design for you. I'll make it fit you to the best of my abilities and make you feel like the boldest, the most beautiful person ever.
Gosh, I like that.
Right.
And then I'm also wondering about, and I don't know why either of you can speak to this, but, you know, there's always the trickle down. So the more Esther Sands there are out there doing what she's doing, and we know there are a lot of them, just individuals with their small companies, custom designing. I'm wondering about what the trickle down effect is for that, because so much of your fabric, it doesn't come from here, right?
No.
It's made in places?
Most of the fabric, some are made in different African countries and some are made in Europe.
Okay.
The biggest European company that makes African fabric is called Vlisco, and it's been in business for a while.
They've been doing this for a long time then.
Yes.
So it's probably the most affordable?
It depends on the quality that you want.
Okay.
It goes anywhere from $20 to 100 to 200.
A yard.
So, yeah. It's more, it comes in 6 yards and 12 yards.
Gotcha.
So that's how usually the fabrics come in. So it depends. And if you want stuff that are actually hand woven from specific countries, those are the traditional wares for those countries. Like the kente cloth is when you actually want an actual Ghanaian kente cloth, it's hand woven. So it comes from Ghana. So you can go to places where it's actually woven and you can sit there and watch them weave it. And
have
that is
that?
More personal. It is pretty amazing to actually see people weave. And it comes in strips that they sew together to make the big kente cloth.
It just seems to me that there's a lot of opportunity here down the food chain of it all.
Oh, for sure. Well, and I think more and more, you know, with online
right.
Being able to buy things, you know, from small makers in other countries so easily, you know, that's changed so much, I think. And people selling online on social media, you know, has really given a lot of opportunities to designers like Esther that, you know, when I got out of school, there was no way, you know, with no internet and no, you know, how would you ever get your word out? So I think that the world has become such a small place through all of this, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah.
It's good because then you get to explore different cultures and you get to see where everything comes from. You get to learn more about where things are coming from.
How long have you been in business?
I've been doing it professionally for about 4 or 5 years.
And has it changed over that 4 or 5 years? What your designs are, how you think about it?
It has changed a lot because now I put more thought into what I'm designing and how it's affecting my clients. I started taking a class, marketing class put on by OMA, Ohio Marketing Association. Mm-hmm. And the instructor has really helped me realize where I want to go with my brand and what thought process goes into every clothing and how it affects my client. So getting that and the process is always evolving. And I learn more every day from the people that buy my stuff and what they say about it and the people that are on the side looking in. And so I get feedback from both sides. It's just sometimes you want a fabric a big fabric shop in Columbus where you can actually go and feel the fabric.
I know. Right? That's the first thing I do. I walk along racks of clothes and all I do is feel it first. We have to end it there. But Esther Sands, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Anne, for having me.
Esther Sands is the CEO and designer of Amamre. And you can learn more about that. We'll have a link to her website on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. And also Suzanne Cotton, Chair of Fashion Design and an Associate Professor at the Columbus College of Art and Design. Thanks for joining us again.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
And thanks everybody else for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.